Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive.
Quite frankly, I get most of my news from you.
Joan Esposito.
Y'all ready for this?
On WCPT 820.
Oh, good morning. Happy Monday. What a week, huh? Well, I hope you had a good weekend, because it looks like it's going to be a rocky ride this week, news-wise. By now, you have no doubt heard there has been a second shooting of a young black man by a police officer in Minnesota. This occurring in a suburb of Minneapolis. This time around, the police are talking very openly and very quickly about what happened. Duante Wright, 20 years old, was apparently pulled over by police because of an expired tag, even though the police chief said in a press conference that because of COVID, all of the registration tags were late going out and that lots of people were going to be driving around with expired tags. And he told his police officers that. That's what he says anyway. He says, Police Chief Tim Gannon said he told his police officers that there were going to be lots of people driving around with expired tags. But still, apparently, that's why 20-year-old Duante Wright was pulled over. A police check was run. He was found to have an outstanding warrant. And so officers attempted to arrest him. The police department has already released the body cam footage and the footage from the dash cam. One officer asks him to get out of the car, starts to handcuff him. That officer is an African American. The young man is also African American. While the officer is trying to put the cuffs on Duante Wright, Duante gets back in the car. And he's apparently, the thinking is he's going to drive away. The officer who was trying to cuff him tries to pull him back out of the car. Another officer who is identifiable only by her hands comes to that officer's aid. Clearly pulls a gun visible on the video, but shouts, "Taser, taser, taser," which is what police officers are trained to shout before they discharge their taser so that other officers know to get out of the way and so that a suspect knows what's about to happen if they don't stop. And then you hear a gunshot. The police chief, Tim Gannon, is saying it was an accidental discharge. Even after the shooting, you can hear the officer who fires her gun, apparently shocked at what she has just done. Matt cut some body cam audio, the Duante Wright body cam footage. It's just a real quick 15 seconds. I'd like to play that now so people can hear what happened. I just shot him. And the other officer says, "Oh, wow." And she says, "Yes." I don't know what is standard practice for this police department, but most police departments, to avoid just this kind of confusion, require officers to carry their taser on one side of their belt and their gun on the other side of their belt. The police chief today didn't comment on that, would not identify the officer who did the shooting other than to say she was a very, very senior officer. Let's listen to a little bit about what the police chief. Now, remember, this is it's a suburb of Minneapolis. This is the Brooklyn police chief, Tim Gannon.
As you can hear, the officer, while struggling with Mr. Wright, shouts, "Taser, taser," several times. That is part of the officer's training prior to deploying a taser, which is a less lethal device. That is done to make her partners aware, as well as the subject, that a taser deployment will be imminent. During this encounter, however, the officer drew their handgun instead of their taser. For informational purposes, we train with our handguns on our dominant side and our taser on our weak side. So if you're right-handed, you carry your firearm on your right side and you carry your taser on the left. This is done purposefully and is trained. As I watch the video and listen to the officer's commands, it is my belief that the officer had the intention to deploy their taser, but instead shot Mr. Wright with a single bullet. This appears to me, from what I viewed and the officer's reaction and distress immediately after, that this was an accidental discharge that resulted in the tragic death of Mr. Wright.
Trained officer, not named but described as very, very senior. Gun on one side, taser on the other. So how the hell does this happen? And if, you know, police officers are trained to deal with high-stress incidents, not to say that they're perfect human beings, not to say that anybody is a perfect human being, but a police officer is expected to behave in a situation like this with more calm and less panic than would be expected of, say, somebody like me in a situation like that. This is what officers are supposed to be trained for. But you heard Brooklyn Center Police Chief Tim Gannon just say her gun should have been on her dominant side, her taser on her non-dominant side. She clearly thought she was pulling her taser. Did she switch sides that day for some reason? She's a very, very senior officer, and she doesn't have enough training to know which weapon is which. Brooklyn Center Mayor Mike Elliott also spoke to the media today. One thing you've got to say is this mayor and this police chief are getting out ahead of this. As I heard one political pundit, a former police chief themselves, say, you know, bad news doesn't get any better if you sit on it. So just get it out there. Mayor Mike Elliott from the Brooklyn Center spoke today to the media before Police Chief Tim Gannon spoke. And he acknowledged that especially for their state, especially for a state now watching the trial of Derek Chauvin, accused of killing George Floyd, that this was the worst possible time for this horrific thing to happen. Listen to the mayor.
We recognize that this couldn't have happened at a worse time. We recognize that this is happening at a time when our community, when all of America, indeed all of the world, is watching our community, that we are all collectively devastated, and we have been for over a year now by the killing of George Floyd, and that we continue to be distressed as we go through the Derek Chauvin trial. So having a police-involved shooting happen in our community and killing a young man is heartbreaking and just unfathomable. And so our entire community is filled with grief at yesterday's police-involved shooting that led to the killing of Dante Wright, a 20-year-old young African-American male. And my hearts go out to Dante's family and to all those who are impacted by this tragedy in our community and the world over.
Speaking of the George Floyd trial, after this shooting of Dante Wright that occurred in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, the defense in the George Floyd trial asked the judge to sequester the jury. He didn't want the jury finding out that there had been another shooting of a black man by a white police officer. Pulled over, by the way, for a traffic stop that apparently, according to the police chief himself, should never have happened. But I digress. The defense motion to get the jury sequestered was denied. And we also heard today that we're not going to hear on the stand testimony from Maurice Hall. Maurice Hall was in the car with George Floyd when George Floyd was pulled out to be arrested. Maurice Hall has invoked the Fifth Amendment, doesn't want to testify, doesn't want to take a chance of incriminating himself. The defense wanted to put him on the stand anyway and told the judge they would work around his concerns. That apparently was not good enough for the judge, who said, no, we will not hear from Maurice Hall, that he has the right to claim the Fifth Amendment and not testify. The thinking was that the defense wanted to talk to him about any drugs he and George Floyd may or may not have been using. It is possible, in fact likely, that the prosecution in the George Floyd Derek Chauvin trial will wrap up this week. The defense will begin their arguments. The defense arguments are expected to be shorter. It's been, well, we're now in the beginning of the third week for the prosecution. We heard from George Floyd's younger brother today, Philonis Floyd, talking about his older brother, George, and things that his older brother did for him when he was growing up. Just very, very humanizing testimony. But interestingly, the prosecution did not rest at that point. The prosecution has now called another expert in the use of force, a former cop who's now a professor at law and apparently a frequent expert court testifier on use of force. That is what we are hearing from now. More to come on that. More to come on the situation, I'm sure, with Dante Wright. And also some news from the COVID task force today. I'll share some of that with you when we come back after this.
Want to add your two cents? You can now call or text us at 773-763-9278. WCPT's text line is sponsored by GWC Injury Lawyers. Visit them at justicestartstoday.com.
Because facts matter. You are listening to WCPT 820.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
George Floyd trial is still continuing. We are going to be bringing you more on that as it unfolds. As I said before, we are expecting the prosecution to rest their case this week. The defense will begin. We don't know how long that will be. Generally, most of the experts I've talked to expect the defense presentation to be shorter than what we have seen from the prosecution. So will it wrap up this week or next week? It's going to wrap up soon. And the defense motion to have the jury sequestered, that means to have the jury basically locked up so that they can't communicate. It usually requires, as soon as they're not in the courtroom, the jury members are taken to a hotel and basically locked in until the next day. Because I think the defense doesn't want the jury to hear about another shooting, the Dante Wright shooting that took place in Brooklyn Center, Minneapolis, a suburb of Minneapolis. The CDC gave another one of their briefings today. Rochelle Walensky, who is head of the Centers for Disease Control, through her COVID briefing that she does with Dr. Fauci a couple of times a week, said that the numbers are still increasing. They're increasing slowly, but they're going back up again. Hospital admissions for COVID are also continuing to increase. We've had a seven-day average of 684 people dying every day. That actually is a slight decrease, but you know, infections are followed a couple of weeks later by hospitalizations, and those are followed a couple of weeks later by deaths. If we're very lucky and doctors have gotten better at treating COVID, even though we've seen an increase in the infection rate on nationwide by about 3%, and even though we've seen a 6% increase in hospital admissions, let's cross our fingers and light a candle that we don't end up a couple of weeks from now reporting that we're getting a increased number of deaths on a daily basis. One of the areas of public health that has been controversial, well, at least it's controversial if you're a Republican, is this idea that racism is a public health issue. Rochelle Walensky talked about that today. She said the Centers for Disease Control have a new website up. It is called Racism and Health, and it is designed to educate people about the intersection of racism and health, and it is also a place where there can be a dialogue about these issues. In Rochelle's own words, racism is a serious public health threat that directly affects the well-being of millions of Americans and the health of our entire nation. We must acknowledge the disparities that exist and commit to an equitable distribution of vaccines, particularly to those communities hardest hit by the virus. Black and brown people in this country are still not receiving the vaccine on a par with the percentage that their numbers should suggest. Also, I want to bring you a couple of the greatest hits from Dr. Fauci today. He talked, you know, Dr. Fauci, when he talks, he knows he's speaking to the public, but he generally speaks like he's talking to other doctors. So today he wanted to talk to a couple of aspects of the COVID vaccines. One is something called a breakthrough infection. That's when a person gets COVID even though they have been vaccinated against this. He said it happens with all vaccines in clinical trials. In the real world, no vaccine is 100% effective. He said that means you're always going to see breakthrough infections. But the good news is that we're not seeing too many of these. There's also something he called primary vaccine failure. And those are the people who get the vaccine and just don't respond to it for whatever reason. Either something's wrong with the vaccine or there's just something quirky about your body. That's primary vaccine failure. There's also something called secondary vaccine failure. That's when your immunity fades over time. In other words, you know, a lot of shots, it's one and done for your whole life. You don't get a booster for your chickenpox vaccine. It's one and done. But the question has been talked about and studied as to whether or not we can expect Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, the immunity that we get from these, how long is it going to last? How long is it going to last? Well, this is all so new that we're finding this stuff out right now. Moderna just released some data last week showing that they're sure the Moderna vaccines are good for at least 6 months. Now, it could be longer, could be a year, could be 5 years, 10 years, could be the rest of our lives. But this is all real new. People are just getting these vaccines. And what they can tell you for absolute positive sure is that if you got your Moderna two shots, you've got 6 months of protection for sure. For those of us, including me, who got Moderna, I'm hoping that as time goes on and that they look at the people who got the vaccines ahead of me, soon there'll be an announcement that says, oh, it's good for a year. Oh, it's good for a year and a half. Now it looks like it's good for 2 years. But remember, Moderna is the company that's already studying whether or not 6 months down the road, a third shot makes it last longer or makes your response stronger. Science is evolving on this. More to come, okay? One other local note I want to mention. One of the issues that we've been following since I first started hosting this radio show has been the laws that the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois have been trying to get on the books to ban puppy mill puppies from being and kitties and rabbits from being sold at pet stores. Well, the city of Chicago passed a law that seemed to have that result, but immediately there were loopholes. Some of the pet stores that were working with puppy mills played a trick where they had the puppy mills create nonprofits so they could still buy the same animals from the same puppy mills, but now technically it was they were getting it from a shelter. Well, today the Committee on Health and Human Relations in the City Council passed a bill that is going to tighten all of those loopholes. So we are looking at a day when dogs, cats, and rabbits from disreputable sources will now not be sold in pet stores. Pet stores are still allowed to sell animals, but they are obliged to take and offer for sale shelter animals, rescues. And if you want to buy a purebred dog, you go directly to the breeders who are in the business of doing this safely and with all of the professional certifications. We're going to take a break. You know, I told you Rochelle Walensky was talking about racism and health. Well, Planned Parenthood of Illinois is focusing on some of the health disparities, particularly when it comes to maternal health, that African-American women experience. We're going to talk about that when we come back after this.
No app? No problem. You can stream WCPT 820 anytime on your tablet or phone directly from WCPT820.com. Don't turn that dial.
A dangerous mistake to make.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive. Returns right now on WCPT 820.
I am joined by Michael Morgan, who's the Black Organizing Program Manager for Planned Parenthood Illinois Action. And he is the expert on what Planned Parenthood of Illinois is doing to advocate for Black maternal health care improvements. Welcome, Michael. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Joan. Good afternoon.
Tell me about the program. Tell me about what Planned Parenthood of Illinois is doing right now.
Of course. So the Black Organizing Program is a national effort under Planned Parenthood Federation of America to uplift and build powerful movements in Black neighborhoods across the United States. So as the program manager for the state of Illinois' affiliate, we are leading and building alongside our partners in the legislature. So we recently helped to draft HB 158, which is on its way to the governor's desk right now, and that is the Health Care and Human Services Reform Act, introduced by one of our partners in the legislature, Representative Camille Lilly. And this is a really big piece of legislation that's going to undo a lot of the systemic racism caked into our healthcare system. Namely, it requires implicit bias training for medical professionals in the state. One of the really big issues impacting Black birthing people is that they will often go into hospitals and complain of issues and are routinely under and undiagnosed because Black folks are often thought to have a higher, are less susceptible to pain. So we don't get the medication that we need. We aren't given the attention that we need. This bill also includes the doula Medicaid expansion program, which is an integral part of putting together a safe and inclusive birth plan. A lot of Black folks, again, traditionally have not been treated well by just the conventional birthing facilities and birthing procedures. So it's important to have those emotional and spiritual anchors alongside folks putting together birthing plans, and especially for Black queer folks doing the same.
You said this is part of a national effort that is being done. So this is taking place, efforts like these, like House Bill 158, things like this are being put forward in other states across the country?
There are. The Black Organizing Program has been around for a few years now. I believe our inaugural one was in 2018 on the East Coast, but there are efforts underway across the U.S. To our neighbors in Michigan, Ohio, to south of us in Missouri, all the way to New York and along the East Coast.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about certain parts of this bill. By the way, does it have a name other than HB 158? Is there any name that it uses words instead of numbers?
There is. It's the Healthcare and Human Services Reform Act.
Okay, Healthcare and Human Services Reform Act. It's going to expand Medicaid services. What about access to doulas and postpartum visits? Is that part of what the expansion would cover?
Yeah, so the expansion covers reimbursement rates for doula services and other family planning programs. So in that way, we are expanding Medicaid and allocating more public dollars for the folks who are providing a really essential part of the birthing process, a particularly spiritual and emotional portion that's routinely overlooked.
You know, there's been a lot of controversy. Joe Biden, in his latest package of, I guess it was a might have been part of the budget, he offered financial incentives for states to expand Medicaid and Medicare. And I was just reading today that even though there's like billions of dollars and the federal government will essentially foot the bill, there are still states, such as Texas, who are resisting these moves. You know, why do you think that is? Is it because they know that these kinds of moves are more likely to help Black and brown people than white people, for God's sake?
I mean, it's. I think that that question has so many different answers that can be racialized and gendered to no end. But ultimately, it's about telling folks what they can and can't do with their bodies and then trying to legislate around that. You know, luckily, Governor Pritzker has been a real champion in making sure that Illinois continues to be a safe state for folks accessing the full spectrum of sexual and reproductive health care, including abortion care. And we look forward to working with President Biden to continuing that fight.
And, you know, you mentioned Governor Pritzker. Is there anything else here in Illinois happening at the state or local level to address these? I know, I think Mayor Lori Lightfoot said within the last couple of weeks that she really wanted to focus on the fact that, you know, simply that Black women don't do so well statistically when they have kids. They die at a higher rate. There's a lot more problems. And she wanted to make some kind of special effort to focus on that problem. What's going on at the local and state level that we should know about?
Well, what's really, like, I think fascinating but also universal about this topic is that it is local everywhere because they are Black birthing people everywhere. I can't speak specifically to what's happening out of the mayor's office, though I do trust she's in coordination with all of the efforts across the city and across the state. But what's headed to the governor's desk now, HB 158, is going to do, I mean, we've only gotten into the very surface of what this bill intends to do in terms of eradicating some of the racist underpinnings of our healthcare system. But this is a bold and comprehensive approach. And as we see it phased into our system over time, over the next few years, I think we'll see very quickly how disparate some of these inequities have been and how easily they could have been fixed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly seems that way. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to Dr. Rochelle Walensky in her COVID briefing this morning, but she said that the CDC is launching a new website, Racism and Health, which, you know, is part of what that's going to focus on is getting, you know, people getting COVID vaccinations. But she also wants it to be a place where people can get educated and have a dialogue about these critical issues. What would you, in a perfect world, like to see as part of that racism and health website from the Centers for Disease Control?
Well, I mean, part of the Black Organizing Program's conception was to not only advance sexual and reproductive health care of Black folks, but to advance the wellness of Black people. And there are so many things that contribute to the overall health of a person. One of our partners in doing like federal work, Congresswoman Lauren Underwood, talks about the social determinants of health that influence our health outcomes, like housing, transportation, and nutrition. So I hope and I am confident that the CDC, in consultation with the president and Vice President Harris, are ensuring that when we talk about the health of a person, we are talking about where they are, but also what caused them to get there and how we can fix that rather than always addressing the symptoms.
On the institutional level, it has been alleged, particularly in the Chicago area, that people in poorer communities generally have the easiest access to hospitals in their neighborhoods. But those hospitals, because they're not the big bucks hospitals, they're not the big Rushes and the Northwesterns or the University of Chicago, they tend to be more neighborhood community hospitals, that they're just not, they don't have the budgets to buy the fancy equipment to have all the stuff, and that's part of the problem. It's not just a poor community, but basically poor hospitals. Do you agree with that?
I do. And insofar that, you know, Representative Lilly made sure that this was addressed in HB 158. So there is a halt on hospital closures for 60 days after the effective date, because just as you said, the issue with so many of the institutions that are, you know, foremost serving Black and brown people often lack the fiscal health to do so in a way that is commensurate with the needs of the community. So it is imminent that as we talk about the accessibility of what folks have in their immediate space, we're also talking about what the needs exactly are and how many dollars, real dollars, have been invested into addressing those concerns.
Well, exactly right. I mean, I was reading that Mercy Hospital is one of the hospitals that's sort of been on the cusp of closing, not closing, closing, not closing. But what good does it do to keep a hospital open unless you can supply it with the funds that it needs to really be a good hospital? The educated staff, the machines, the newest CT scanner, the newest kinds of bandages or tubes. You know, just saying it has to stay open, to me, doesn't necessarily do the community any good.
I agree wholly. And you know, that's why we have been so persistent in our Senior Director of Public Policy, Bridget Leahy, extremely, extremely brilliant woman who's been working so diligently with the various caucuses and committees to ensure that we are addressing those immediate needs as well.
What can our listeners do to help?
So, luckily, we are at an interesting time organizationally, but also communally, and we are transitioning back into some of our in-person organizing efforts. We have a really robust canvassing campaign coming up, and we're going to have a lot of volunteer opportunities for folks, not only in the city of Chicago, but across the state of Illinois to get involved. So please follow our various social media channels, Planned Parenthood Illinois Action, and visit our website where you can sign our volunteer listserv. It's the Black Organizing Program. We have recently launched a really fantastic one-to-one series with some of our external stakeholders, electeds, and partners. There's a fantastic one that I just completed with Congresswoman Lauren Underwood that'll be up later this week. So there are a lot of ways to get involved, and so much information is available on our website. So take a look and hit us up.
On the website, does it say what the specific volunteer tasks are? I mean, is it going to be knocking on doors or holding community meetings or answering phones? What's that mean?
Of course. So it's sort of everything you just described. There are different echelons, of course, pursuant to whatever one's accommodations are. We have options to just do the phone banking and just do text banking. There are some options for in-person canvassing or door knocking. And then we also are looking to source and develop volunteer leaders who can help us oversee some of our efforts across the state. So there's room for everybody.
There's a job. No job is too big or too small, right?
Absolutely. We are organizing horizontally.
Yes. And this may be outside of your purview, Michael. I'm not trying to throw you a curveball necessarily, but I know one of the big pushes for Planned Parenthood here in Illinois has been to get the Parental Notification Act repealed, taken off the books, even though right now it's really not being enforced the way it was written. Do you know anything about where those efforts stand?
Where the efforts stand, I am not certain. And to your preamble, I would not feel comfortable speaking to the status of the legislation. But just as a personally and both as a representative of Planned Parenthood, you know, of course, we support all of those efforts and we see it as an unnecessary block towards accessing the full spectrum of healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Michael, thank you so much. Is there anything you wanted to share with our listeners before we wrap up?
Thank you so much for having me on to talk about the efforts underway across the state. I hope to be back and to have some more exciting things to talk about in the future.
Excellent. We want to hear every bit of progress you make, okay?
Okay. Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you. Michael Morgan, Black Organizing Program Manager for Planned Parenthood Illinois Action. We are going to take a break. We're going to be back with more news right after this.
Don't want to call but have something to say?
Am I in the air?
You can now text us at 773-763-9278. WCPT's text line is sponsored by GWC Injury Lawyers. Visit them at justicestartstoday.com.
WCPT 820, Chicago's progressive talk, where facts matter.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive. Every weekday afternoon from 2 to 5 p.m. on WCPT 820.
We are going to be joined, as we are each week on Monday, by Andrea Darlis at 3 p.m., but there's a couple of local things that I wanted to mention. First of all, you know, there's been this controversy about General Iron. That's the metal shredding company that was very unpopular in Lincoln Park and closed up shop there and then announced that they were going to be moving to Southeast Chicago. A lot of residents in the South and West Side say that they're really tired of poor neighborhoods becoming dumping grounds for companies that they consider polluters. Well, this might actually go all the way up to the top levels of the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, we, of course, have a new EPA chief, Michael Regan. And Michael Regan has said in public that community-focused environmental equity, will be part of the DNA of the new Environmental Protection Agency under his stewardship. Well, people who live in the southeast side of Chicago are saying that's exactly what this fight over General Iron is. It is about environmental equity. It is about the habit of dumping polluting industries in poorer communities. This move of General Iron to the southeast side of Chicago may call into question whether Michael Regan is going to really work to have community-focused environmental equity, as he said. So this may involve more than the mayor of Chicago before all is said and done. The other thing, then, this is a really kind of quirky thing. I don't know if it got much media attention. Remember when there was all the controversy about statues and people were rioting over statues and should Confederate statues should be pulled down and then who else should be pulled down? And because she was afraid that the Trump administration was going to make the statues of Christopher Columbus a focus for controversy and potentially rioting, with the cooperation of various community groups, including Italian Americans, the two or three statues, I think there were three statues in the city of Chicago of Christopher Columbus, they were removed and they were taken out of public view. It was supposed to be temporary. They were supposed to figure this out later. And, of course, nothing has happened about it. Nobody seems to know whether the statues are coming back, where they're coming back to, if they're coming back, and under what circumstances. Well, this is so weird. The Joint Civic Committee of Italian Americans was looking into the paperwork surrounding at least one of these statues. And when they looked through the paperwork, apparently when the statue or statues were erected, the park district said in writing in a signed contract that they would obtain the written approval of the Joint Civic Committee of Italian Americans before making any substantial change to Columbus Plaza or the statue. Nobody even knew that document existed, apparently, till the JCCIA asked the city, you know, send us all your paperwork on this. We're trying to figure out, you know, what we're going to ask for and what we're going to ask you to do. And they found this document that said that, frankly, they were supposed to give their permission for the statue to be removed officially in the first place. So, where do we go from here? Well, the president of the JCCIA wrote a letter to the Chicago Park District Board and its legal counsel, telling them about this letter, telling them about the history of the JCCIA agreement with the Chicago Park District, and why they think mothballing this statue that was in the Columbus, in the plaza, is of concern and something that should be discussed and was probably removed illegally. Part of the letter says, we're hopeful that the Chicago Park District will honor what we feel to be a solid, enforceable contract. These statues are important to our community and represent generations of traditions. We know the original intention of removing the statues was one of safety, but that was months ago. And it's time to return them. I look forward to a dialogue towards a resolve of the park district obtaining the statues from the city and putting them back. More to come on that one. Isn't that interesting? Going through this paperwork and finding a legal document that said, oh, by the way, we should have signed off. It shouldn't have. None of this should have happened with us legally agreeing. We shall see. We shall see what happens. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined, as we are most Mondays, by Andrea Darlis. We are going to recap for you what has been happening with the Dante Wright shooting in a Minneapolis suburbs, Brooklyn Center, and we are going to talk about the George Floyd trial. That and more when we come back after this.
Podcasts of Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive, are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud. Just search WCPT 820. Joan Esposito, live.
Celebrating our power to bring about change.
Local.
Everybody has to work together.
And progressive.
I think you get the idea.
On WCPT 820.
It is 3 o'clock, and on Mondays at 3 o'clock, I am joined by the lovely and talented Andrea Darlis. Andrea, how are you today?
Joan, I am great. How are you doing today?
Reasonably well for a Monday.
right.
And I want all of our listeners to know, you know, Andre and I talk about all of the news of the day. So if somebody would like to talk about something, we're going to talk about the Chauvin trial. I'm going to bring you up to date on what's happened today and what we expect to happen for the rest of the week. But if there are other things that you would like to talk about, remember that number, 773-763-9278. You can call us on that line. You can text us on that line. Our texting is sponsored by GWC Injury Law. You can get more information at justicestartstoday.com. And, you know, so feel free to reach out. So, have you been watching the trial, Andrea? What are your thoughts so far about the Derek Chauvin trial? For those of you listening, Derek Chauvin is the former Minneapolis police officer whose knee was on George Floyd's neck as he was face down on the ground, handcuffed. His knee was on his neck for the vicinity of 9 minutes, and George Floyd died. And Derek Chauvin now faces second-degree, third-degree murder charges as well as manslaughter charges. We are in the beginning of the third week of his trial. Andrea, your thoughts?
Joan, I have to tell you, this trial, and I think you would probably agree, has been so emotional. I mean, I know we've seen trials before. You and I, we've covered trials before. But just the emotions, the raw emotions of this trial, so far, of course, the prosecution presenting their witnesses is first. But I found the majority, if not all, of their witnesses to be very credible, very believable. Everybody from the store clerk to the gentleman who was wearing the white glasses, who was recounting, you know, he was one of the witnesses
Mr.
who
McMillan.
Saw George Floyd being arrested. Yeah, yeah. And even Joan, the Minneapolis police supervisors who were taking the stand saying, hey, you know, this was not protocol. You know, that was their testimony. And then they were calling in witnesses from bigger police departments like the Los Angeles Police Department saying that, yes, you know, this was wrong. And of course, you know, we're talking about the prosecution witnesses. So, but I just find the trial to be very emotional. You know, it's invoking these raw emotions and these, you know, feelings that you don't normally see in a trial of this magnitude.
Yeah, and that continued today. I mean, we heard from George Floyd's brother, Philonis Floyd, and talking about, you know, just what kind of a man he was and how, you know, even though he couldn't cook, he made sure all of his younger siblings had a snack when they went to school and make sure they got dressed, and how the death of their mom, which had happened several months before, had hit him hard, and really just painting a very human picture. And I thought it was really interesting that when Philonis finished his testimony, the defense just was like, you know, no cross, just let him go. Just let him go. Didn't want to touch that.
Joan, I found interesting, too, that many of these witnesses, the defense, they don't want to touch the witnesses. Like you said, they let it go. They let it rest. I found Philonis very credible, very believable. What I also found interesting too is they were talking about the opioid addiction, you know, and the opioid struggle, and it's not like they're hiding this and saying, oh no, that wasn't the case. But you know, and then his ex-girlfriend testified too, that, you know, their struggle with opioids. So again, that brings it back to a very real picture that is such a problem in our society today anyway, you know, the opioid addiction crisis. So you have two obviously very big emotionally charged topics like that. But yeah, I found the brother's testimony, Philonis, very, very interesting and very emotional as well.
Yeah. And then, of course, on top of everything today, we have the shooting and killing of Dante Wright, 20 years old, pulled over for having expired tags. This is in Brooklyn Center, which is a suburb of Minneapolis, which is really going through a bad time. And what we have learned in that shooting is that the senior officer who shot Dante Wright apparently did so accidentally. She apparently, according to the police chief, thought she had grabbed her taser, and instead she had grabbed her gun. It's just It's just unbelievable. Steve is calling in from the Gold Coast and wants to join our conversation. Hey, Steve, how are you? You're on with Joan and Andrea.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And I, too, wanted to raise this point about what happened this weekend in terms of the suburb of Minneapolis, because as much as I think we are all suffering from COVID fatigue, you know, there is a bit of a downside to, you know, looking forward to some sort of herd immunity at the same time that we may get a verdict that will satisfy some people, perhaps not everyone, in the Chauvin trial. And then to add insult to injury, we've got another shooting in that general area where you had the George Floyd incident take place. So in short, what I'm trying to say is that within a month, when things start to open up and people feel like they can get back out on the streets, the question is, are they going to get back out on the streets in terms mm-hmm. of what I'm saying? Are we going to see civil unrest? Are we going to see destruction of property? Are we going to see elevated crime rates in the midst of legitimate protests? And that's what I'm fearful of, because I don't know if we can handle another summer of that sort of thing. I think that there are honest-to-goodness protesters out there, and I think that we need to defend their right to turn out and to peacefully protest what is, in my view, an unjust system in this country. At the same time, this is being used by exploited by other people who use it to commit crimes, to loot, to rob, to do all sorts of things that none of us are interested in. And those of us who live in Chicago, just to be clear, I know there are people out there who are listening who are not from Chicago. We had this sort of two-tiered unrest. We had it in late May. And given what happened with the George Floyd incident. And then in August, we had another round of looting, which had very little to do with protesting. It was simply a open season on I want things on Michigan Avenue and the near north side. And, you know, it had very little to do with protests. It was simply a license to loot. And unfortunately, I think that, you know, these things get conflated, but we need to make distinctions. And I'm fearful about, like I said, the perfect storm coming, in which we have a summer in which people can feel free to get out there because they've been vaccinated. But then what are they going to do in the midst of all of these things? I don't have the answers, and I don't pretend to know where we draw the line in terms of what's justice and what's permissible as far as protest and what's not. But I know that it's not going to be a pretty summer anywhere in America if we don't somehow account for these things going forward.
It's interesting that you bring that point up, Steve, because there was a report in both the Sun-Times and the Trib that Chicago Police Superintendent David Brown met with all 50 aldermen, and he was there to talk to them about what the plans were, or that the fact that there was a plan in place should there be protests after the George Floyd Derek Chauvin trial verdict. And he also, now go ahead.
They were on alert this past weekend because the young man, the 13-year-old young man who was boy, actually, who was shot by Chicago police last week, they thought that video was going to become public. So they went to 12-hour shifts, and I know a few Chicago police officers, high ranking, and they thought that was going to happen this weekend. It didn't happen, and fortunately for them, the weather was sort of advantageous for them, in that, you know, cold and dreary and rainy keeps people off the streets. But when that becomes public, there's going to be this question of whether or not Chicago could then see its own unrest.
Well, speaking to that point, another thing that David Brown told the alderman, and there's two conflicting reports. One alderman said that Superintendent Brown said that he expected, because of the fact that so many people have been cooped up from the pandemic, he expected 10 times the number of people this summer to be at the lakefront than we usually see. Another alderman
Absolutely.
Reported to the papers what he thought he heard David Brown say was that there could be as much as 10 times the normal amount of violence. So it's a little unclear exactly what David Brown said to the alderman, but he is prepared for the George Floyd verdict, or at least he says he is.
If
he wanted
might,
the alderman.
Might, If I might, the last point I wanted to make is that having been a resident down here for a long time, I will tell you that they are really making an effort. The Chicago police are up and down Michigan Avenue in the side streets. Their lights are on. They are making a huge effort to send the message to people who might think about coming downtown, where the restaurants, where the hotels are, where retail. This is the part of the city, and I understand that, you know, all parts of the city matter. But in terms of revenue generating areas, in 2019 we had over 50 million visitors to Chicago. And as much as I think the Edgewater neighborhood is a nice place, they don't come to go to Edgewater. And they don't come to go to Inglewood. They come to be downtown. That's where they spend their money. A lot of
it's the economic engine.
And exactly. It's the economic engine. It's the tax base that drives this city so that we can fund other things. And if we lose those people because they don't feel safe coming down here and the stores close and all of these things happen, people who live in the Midwest, they flock to Chicago because there's money in Wisconsin. You know what there isn't in Wisconsin? There's not a Saks Fifth Avenue or a Neiman Marcus in the entire state. There isn't a Neiman Marcus or Saks Fifth Avenue in the entire state of Indiana. There's money there. Those people love to come to Chicago. But if they don't feel safe, we lose them. What
exactly
happens then?
Exactly.
Thank
exactly. Thank you, Steve. We need to take a break. Andrea Darlis and I will be back with more on this right after a break.
Do you want to get in on the conversation? You can now call or text us at 773-763-9278. WCPT's text line is sponsored by GWC Entry Lawyers. Visit them at justicestartstoday.com.
This is WCPT 820, where facts matter.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
It is Monday, and I am joined by Andrea Darlis. Andrea, Steve had a lot of good points. Before we go back to the phone lines, I wanted to give you a chance to weigh in on what he was saying.
He absolutely did. I mean, first and foremost, you know, we want to just keep the city safe, the entire city, north side, south side, west side. And I was very happy that Superintendent Brown did meet with the aldermen. You know, we do need clarification on. I think what he meant, Joan, is that there's going to be 10 times as many people out because we were all, you know, this is 1 year ago is when the memes of Mayor Lightfoot came out where she's, you know, guarding the lakefront, but now it's open again. So now we've all kind of reemerged. But I was very happy that he met with all of the aldermen. I know Alderman Lopez wasn't extremely happy with it, you know, that he wanted to.
He was the one who said that he thought Brown said 10 times the crime. And I thought, well, that's not what the other aldermen said.
I don't think that was the case. I'm hoping that is not the case. But it's good to know that the city does have a plan. CPD, OEMC, CFC, and are meeting with the aldermen and all of the aldermen and sharing the plan of how to keep the city safe in light of the Chauvin verdict, as well as as we prepare to watch the release of the body cam footage from the shooting of the 13-year-old. So, yeah, I mean, the fact that they're meeting and preparing makes me feel good as a Chicago resident that, you know, they are making plans to keep the city safe no matter what happens.
Yeah, and today in the Derek Chauvin trial, we have heard from George Floyd's younger brother, Philonis, talking about what kind of a brother he was. We heard from a cardiologist, Dr. Jonathan Rich, who took the stand to say essentially that George Floyd did not die of a heart attack. He did not die of a drug overdose. And then we heard from a use of force expert that said, among other things, that when he sees that video of the four officers holding George Floyd and unresisting George Floyd down, he said, this is a former cop who became a lawyer and is now a law professor and is a use of force expert. And he said, you know, two officers could have stood with George Floyd while the other two officers investigated this forgery charge. He said that what he saw was not what needed to or should have happened. Let's go back to the phone lines. Lawrence is calling in from Morton Grove. Hey, Lawrence, how are you?
Quite good, John. And your guest, I keep thinking about the questions in this case. I mean, for myself, I just when these cases come up, I just let the legal system. Seems the legal system is working, and I think everybody should. Not obviously, a lot of people are not going to like the verdict, whatever the verdict is, but they should still abide by it lawfully. And when I heard this new case, where somebody got shot, I think I heard that it was during a scuffle. They said it was a resisting arrest case, just like the Floyd one was, resisting arrest. Now, if these people, I mean, it's very unpleasant to even be stopped by police. I know when I've been stopped for nothing just because I was walking in places where people almost never walk. You don't see people walking, they're just driving. But it's unpleasant, but you basically have to go along with it, unless you're brutally attacked, of course. And if there hadn't been resistance of arrest in both of these Minneapolis cases, it seems to me, nothing bad would have really happened, most likely.
I disagree strongly with what you just said, because Lawrence, George Floyd stopped resisting long, long, long before he lost consciousness. And even after he lost consciousness, even after passersby were begging police to just check for a pulse, Derek Chauvin did not move off of George Floyd until not just even the paramedics arriving. The paramedics had to tell him to get off of George Floyd. George Floyd, who was foaming at the mouth, had had a mild seizure, had stopped breathing, had peed himself as he died. No, that was not resisting arrest. And frankly, this young man, Dwayne Wright, who's 20 years old, he was pulled over by the police because he had expired tags, even though the police chief told his officers that there were going to be lots of people driving with expired tags because of COVID, none of the re-registrations were being processed. So they shouldn't have pulled him over in the first place. He came out of the car. They started to handcuff him. And then he panicked. He started to try to get back in the car. The officer who was trying to handcuff him was trying to pull him back out of the car. His partner came up and behind him, there was no reason to think that the first officer even needed any help. And his partner came up behind him and shot the kid. I'm sorry. That's not justifiable.
That's not my main point, Joan.
Well, you just said if they hadn't resisted arrest, none of this would have happened. And I don't think that's I don't think that's true, Lawrence.
It seemed to start with resisting arrest now.
George Floyd's case did not start with resisting arrest. It started with a store owner calling because they thought he had tried to pass a bad 20. And even the store clerk said, you know, that he wasn't even sure that George Floyd was aware that it was a bad bill. And he debated about whether or not he should even call his manager.
Yeah, I've heard all that before. But I'm just trying to say that resisting arrest is a dangerous thing to do. Like, I was stopped just because I was walking in a neighborhood where I worked for years and years and years. The policeman was saying, we got a call about somebody walking carrying a bag. Even to stop somebody, I carried a bag. It looked sort of like a Santa Claus bag on my back. Big deal. And so I just said to him, I said, look, I work with policemen. I said, do you know Officer such and such? And he says, yeah. And they says, okay, you can go now. But I didn't like it, and it's easy to get.
And I think somebody who does resist arrest, the police are justified subduing that person. But I think that we need to train our police how to subdue someone without using deadly force. I mean, I think this was, frankly, this 20-year-old, it sounds like it. Sometimes you do, but almost never, Lawrence. Almost
no, no, I mean,
never. Our police officers in this country resort to using their guns much too often, much too early, much too easily on the whole. And I'm not saying that all officers do this, but I'm saying it happens way, way too much. Anyway, we're coming up against a break, and I want to give Andrea a chance to join our conversation, Lawrence. Thank you for calling. Andrea, you want to weigh in here?
Yeah. Do you want to take a break, or do you want me to weigh in?
Oh, we got a minute before we go. I just wanted to I wanted to get your take.
So here's the difference in the Chauvin case as opposed to the shooting in the suburb about 10 miles from where the trial is actually taking place in Minneapolis over the weekend. Dante Wright, this police officer immediately, as far as everything I've been reading, has said immediately, you know, almost like, yes, I did this. It was an accident. She shouted, taser, taser, you know, as they're trained to do.
Mm-hmm.
They grabbed her gun as well. So I almost don't think you can put these in the same category as far as, you know, use of, well, you can with use of deadly force, but not as far as restraining, you know, so that's kind of my main point. And I know you're up against the clock here too, but that's where I think these two cases differ.
Andrea and I are going to take a break after we break for traffic. We will be back with more on this. We're going to continue our discussion. We're going to continue taking your calls in just a minute, right after this.
Take Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive with you on the go by using the TuneIn app on your phone. Just search for WCPT 820. Now back to Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
It is Monday, and I am joined by Andrea Darlis. We are talking about the Derek Chauvin trial. There has also been another shooting in Minneapolis, this one in Brooklyn Center, an apparently accidental police shooting. A senior officer thought she was reaching for her taser. She shouted, taser, 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 but she apparently grabbed her gun and shot 20-year-old Dante Wright, pulled over for expired tags on his car. I want to replay for you some of the audio from the police body cam as this was happening. It's real quick. Just listen to this. Just tragic. The officer has not been named. She's been described as someone who's very, very senior. The police chief of Brooklyn Center, a man by the name of Tim Gannon, said that their officers are supposed to wear their guns on their dominant hand side. They are supposed to wear their tasers on the non-dominant hand side in an effort to make sure that they don't get mixed up. What happened and exactly how it happened, you heard just there. Let's go back to the phone lines. Jim is calling in from Chicago. Hey, Jim, you're on with Joan and Andrea.
Hi, Andrea. Hi, Joan. Yeah, real quick, I was almost shot by a cat when I was 13. I was staying out late at night. The cat got sick of chasing me. He threw a shot at me. He just missed my head. I got beat up by the cops. The point is, we glorify the cops. As I was a little kid, we were watching cop shows. They're always they're always doing the right. They're right. They're as crazy as anybody else in the street. I mean, we went from about 400,000 people incarcerated when I was a kid. Now it's about 3 million. We're throwing people in jail at tremendous rates, and these cops are just as screwy as anybody else in the street. I mean, you can't differentiate between who's a nutty cop and who isn't a nutty cop. You've got the FBI on. You've got every TV show you watch. They glorify the police, and we're being stuck in prison more than ever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you guys have a great afternoon. Thank you, Jim.
Bye-bye. You know, Andrea, Jim raised a really interesting point. I don't know if you saw this. I read the New York Times, Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, mm-hmm. the Sun-Times, and the Trib usually every day. And I'm not always certain. I remember an article. I'm not always certain where it came from. But there was basically an essay, an editorial on just exactly what Jim was talking about. You know, we have all these cop shows and the cops are always the good guys, and that, you know, the sort of mythological tale we tell ourselves about who cops are and what they do doesn't always reflect the reality, and our TV shows don't reflect the reality of what policing is like today. I think he raises a really interesting point. One of the, I think it's one of the shows, what might be Chicago PD, actually announced at the beginning of their season that they were going to try to address some of these issues. It's not a show I watch, so I can't say whether or not they've done it or whether they're still planning to do it in the future. But they acknowledged that there was this, there were sort of these two realities, you know, the white knight cop we see on television versus the stories like, you know, George Floyd and Derek Chauvin and Dante Wright and the police officer in his instance. Do you think if cop shows tried to be more reflective of society and policing as it truly exists, do you think a lot of people would view the whole issue of police violence differently?
You know, that's an awesome question. And that's a great point that Jim raises, too. I mean, I know a lot of course, what we see on TV is fictionalized, you know, although I know they have consults or, you know, consultants on many of the law shows, you know, the, for, you know, real life lawyers weighing in. I know Chicago PD, Chicago Fire, they have, of course, consultants as well. I have found I love to watch. I have to admit, I don't watch Chicago PD, Chicago Fire all that much. I always kind of question the acting, you know.
I don't watch them at all, so I can't comment.
Yeah, I don't at all. But I did like to watch those shows for the Chicago scene, you know, so I could mm-hmm. say, oh, yeah, I used to live over there. You know, I liked seeing that. I do watch, there's a new show I watched. It's called Clarice. And it's about, you know, the Jodie Foster character from Silence of the Lambs. And she's a young female agent. I have really noticed a shift in how they try to be a more fair and more realistic, and they have a Hispanic-American FBI agent. They have an African-American female agent. They have a Muslim agent. So I've noticed, I love the diversity of mm-hmm. that show, and I like how they really try and address, you know, some of these real-life concerns, if you will, Joan. You know, the African-American female agent is talking about joining the Black Caucus. So it's very interesting to me. I've noticed a change in at least the shows that I watch. You know, again, I don't watch Chicago PD and Chicago Fire. I probably should. But I have noticed, you know, recently, and I think it's for the better. I think it's good that they're trying to mimic real life situations mm-hmm. in real life now as it is in 2021.
Yeah, I was just trying to think while you were talking, are there any cop shows that I regularly watch? And there aren't. I can't honestly, I guess as close as I get to watching a cop show is watching SEAL Team on CBS. I'm a big David Boreanaz fan. But, you know, even that show, which deals with, you know, Navy SEALs and the military, and they're very much the good guys, that show has a lot of realism. I mean, they bring, you know, politics into it, not just, and, you know, the politics of what they can do and the politics of, you know, scapegoating, you know, and a lot of the mm-hmm. trauma. They had a whole big arc on the fact that for head trauma, vets weren't getting the help they needed at the VA. I mean, they've really taken on some very thorny issues that are being discussed today. It isn't just the, you know, we're Navy SEALs and, you know, it's another episode of We Save the Day. They really have taken on some heavy issues. And they've done it really, you know, in a very thought-provoking way.
Joan, there's another show. It's called The Equalizer, and it's with Queen Latifah. So, and a lot of these shows, of course, you realize it's fictionalized. You know, they have 1 hour, and they always solve the case. So, you know, you got to keep in mind that. However, I just love this show because, again, it's about female empowerment. It's Queen Latifah. she has her sidekick is a Navy SEAL female who is just outstanding, Asian-American female. So, again, I love the diversity of that. And that show deals with a lot of white-collar crime. You know, so it's not just, you know, these made-up accounts of, oh, we're going into this, you know, questionable area. And you know, it's white-collar crime, which is another facet that a lot of viewers don't see sometimes. So I do like, that's another show that I do watch, a police drama.
You had me at Queen Latifah. Okay.
I know.
You don't have to say anything else. Queen Latifah reads the phone book. I'm there.
So bad. I love her.
Let's go to the phone lines. Robert is calling in from Buffalo Grove. Hey, Robert, you're on with Joan and Andrea.
Oh, hello there. Thanks for taking my call. Long-time fan, first-time
Thanks.
Caller. I just want to comment quickly, the resisting arrest. I didn't see him resisting arrest. I don't know if I'm right or not, but I just think that's a talking point for people that defend the cops. They always say, if you want to not get shot, obey them. But mm-hmm. I didn't really see any fight here. I didn't see any resisting arrest. Well, how about you?
Well, that was the point that, you know, if you're talking about the Derek Chauvin trial, all the, oh my God, they had police, they had use of force experts, and they were all saying, even if there was a point early on where George Floyd needed some kind of police subduing, that point was over very quickly, and the police didn't react to that. There was a use of force expert today who said that, you know, use of force isn't like one and done. It's you react to the constantly changing situation. And once George Floyd was subdued and stopped any kind of protest at all, what the police were doing to him and with him should have changed accordingly. You make a very good point, Robert, and thank you for being a first-time caller. I hope you will call back again and again and again. Thank you. Well, let's go back to the phone lines. We got time for one or two more. Dave is calling from the South Side. Hey, Dave, how are you? Oh, okay. Let's go to Earl, who's calling from Hyde Park.
Hi, John. Thank you very much. You guys, great conversation. And the only thing I wanted to bring up is my buddy Steve came on a little earlier and said about the economic engine down on the Gold Coast and stuff. But I was going to suggest the other side of that, too, is maybe that we wouldn't have to worry about the economic engine. It's the community around here put pressure on the police department to better interact with black and brown people. We should not have to be subjected to some of the abuse that we are subjected to. And I'm a black man, and I've been subjected to abuse, and I've been fortunate that I haven't been shot. So yeah. I understand what you're saying about we need economic engine because we can't afford, the people can't afford to pay all of our bills. But, you know, the police should be held accountable for their bad actions, and they should be, you know, have better training. You know, that should be an emphasis. That should not be another case where we have to worry about a bad interaction between somebody black yeah. and somebody in the police force.
Thank you very much, Earl. The police chief of Minneapolis testified that they do have continuing education on updated policies, including use of force, and that Derek Chauvin had 40 hours of training. I'm not quite sure when, but 40 hours of training simply on use of force. Let's take one more call, Andre, before we go to a break. Mm-hmm. Todd is calling in from Naperville. Hey, Todd, how are you?
Hey, Joan. Hey, Joan. How you doing?
Good.
And Andre. well, I had a question more or less a statement about the tactics that are being used nowadays. The thing is that you get some of these, you know, especially after the pandemic and this and that, you get some of these SWAT guys, the SWAT team guys. They're trained to be, like killers, when they have to. And when the SWAT goes out and they put them on the street, they carry that, Hello?
Hi, I'm here, Todd. Todd,
oh, okay.
Are you there?
I'm here. When you get these SWAT guys out there, they carry, chauvinistic, I'm a bigger guy than you, and I could kill you any way you want, You put those guys out on the street, just the regular cop cars and pulling people over, that becomes a problem because these guys are trained in a different way as opposed to, the normal, Mr. Friendly cop, mm-hmm. that's supposed to be a civil servant,
Yeah.
And I'm questioning that because, my dad was a cop himself. He was he used to be a chief of the Cook County Sheriff's Police, and then he retired as a major. And they didn't deal with that kind of stuff back in the day, you know. And I don't think my dad ever fired a shot against any human being in his life. You know, it was just about knowing what you got to say, you know, handling the situation.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he was in the middle of the 68 riot, you know. And I just wanted to put that out, you know, so some people can comprehend how policing used to be and how it should be and where it is now. And where it is now is not where it needs to be.
Thank you for that, Todd. I appreciate the call. Andrea, I'm going to give, I know you have to take off early today. You have another commitment, and I'm going to give you the last word here before we go to our break.
Joan, I think Todd just summed that up beautifully. I really do. Most police, I would hazard to say, don't fire their gun, or maybe one time in an entire service. You know, you're talking about, you know, I think police would even look at the Derek Chauvin case and say, 9 minutes and 29 seconds? Yeah. That's excessive use. Yeah, that's a long time to be doing what he did. So, yes, there are a few bad apples in every profession. And you know, that doesn't go. What I will say, Joan, is that I'm really happy that, you know, it seems to me that Mayor Lightfoot and Superintendent Brown have really made a conscious effort to be transparent and increase training for Chicago police, you know, increase protection for the north side, the west side, and the south side, you know, because businesses in all of these areas were affected by what happened last summer as well. So, you know, I think the city of Chicago, anyway, is taking steps in the right direction, you know, to train their police officers. I mean, I've even seen business liaison sergeants, or rather business liaison officers, who are out and about. And, you know, we saw the program this summer about, you know, getting into the community and helping the community and shovel the snow. And, you know, hopefully there's going to be more efforts like that this summer, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we are on the right path. We'll see what happens in Minnesota. I found it interesting that the judge in the case didn't sequester the jurors after the shooting on Sunday. But the judge said that they will, in fact, be sequestered once the closing arguments start. So we'll be watching for that. Something to talk about for sure next week, Joan.
Yeah, thank you, Andrea. And thanks for being here. I know how busy you are.
Always.
We'll let you go. Thank you. We'll take a break. We're going to be back with more of your calls and some more sound from the Derek Chauvin trial right after this.
Since we have to social distance, we can get social on the socials instead.
Stay 6 feet apart, blah, blah, blah.
Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We don't even have to wear a mask.
WCPT 820.
You're listening to WCPT 820 because facts matter.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
And we are back in the 4 o'clock hour. I'm going to be joined by Chicago Tribune columnist Heidi Stevens. But before we get there, I wanted to take some more of your calls and share some more of the Derek Chauvin trial, some of the testimony from a cardiologist. First, let's go back to the phone lines. Al is calling in from Indiana. Hey, Al, how are you?
Hi, Joan. Good, very good. You're our hero. I just wanted to expand a little bit on the earlier caller about, deifying police. I think we're actually making the police job more dangerous. We're asking them to do things for society that is way beyond their role. I think, and part of that, I believe, it's even bigger than that. You know, in this Trump era, if you remember the Tea Party before Trump, remember all the white males? I'm sorry. Remember all the white males that used to dress up, like the kids call it, cosplay, costume play? And they'd wear, what do you call it? Early American uniforms.
Outfits from colonial times. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. Well, anyway, that was the whole thing. Well, you know, there was that. Now you've got this thing where you see these guys dressing up, armed to the hilt, bulletproof vests on, multiple clips, walkie-talkies, and they all think they're going to be stars of Red Dawn. the movie, and they're all going to be heroes. You know, this is all to build up the poor, in my estimation. This is to build up the esteem of the poorer, middle-class, and blue-collar white males as they become more and more vulnerable in how they feel. You know, the right wing especially tries to bolster them and manipulate them and use them in a way that's extremely dangerous. So you look at the insurrectionists. You know, how many of them had uniforms on? The guy with the horns and that whole thing, as if he's, you know, melding the Native American spirit with the pioneer spirit embodied in a white man. You know, I mean, how ridiculous can you be?
And to go back to your earlier point, you're absolutely right. I mean, we ask so much of our police officers, not just police, but we ask them to be social workers and we ask them to be mental health counselors. And, you know, there's some suggestion that, you know, maybe we should have a different kind of force that does traffic stuff. You know, maybe police officers should be freed up to actually pursue serious crime as opposed to somebody who's got an expired tag. It seems so many of these things that go wrong start with a traffic stop. I mean, there's even been talk that, you know, maybe that would be better handled by other people. But we do. Every time we have a societal problem, we ask the police to fix it, and that's not fair.
Absolutely. I mean, what's piled on these men and women in the police departments. They have to address medical issues in a serious way or face repercussions. They have to address violent issues. They have to address mental health issues, as you say. You know, they have to be priests in certain situations that sympathize with. It's just way overburdening these police departments. It's just unfair. You should pay them three or four salaries almost for what you expect out of them. And it's just overwhelming, I would imagine, and depressing. Can you imagine the depression of that job going to? It's almost like you're cleaning up the detritus of the culture. You know,
I can't imagine
the
seeing the worst of humanity and seeing even good people on the worst day of their lives. I know. I have an inkling what a horrible toll that can take. Thank you, Al. Thanks for calling in. I really appreciate the kind words. Before we go to break, I wanted to share a couple of things that were said in the Derek Chauvin trial today. One of the prosecution witnesses was a cardiologist, a doctor by the name of Jonathan Rich. And the prosecution is trying to refute what they are sure is going to be a defense strategy, trying to lay some of the blame for George Floyd's death on either his heart not being optimal or him being on drugs. One of the very first things that Dr. Rich said today was that it wasn't his heart, it wasn't drugs. This is real quick, but listen to this.
After reviewing all of the facts and evidence of the case, I can state with a high degree of medical certainty that George Floyd did not die from a primary cardiac event, and he did not die from a drug overdose.
Later on the stand, Dr. Rich said that George Floyd didn't have to die. He talked about what police could have done to prevent it. This could have been preventable. Listen to Dr. Rich on that.
I believe that Mr. George Floyd's death was absolutely preventable.
Were there critical points in time during his subdual and restraint on the ground when you feel measures could have or should have been taken that would have preserved his life?
Yes, I do. I think there were several junctures, actually.
Would you tell us about those?
Sure. Well, the first, of course, was to not subject him to that initial prone restraint positioning that he was subjected to. I mean, that is first and foremost. So if that was not the case, I don't think he would have died. The second, though, was when he was in that subdual and restraint positioning, and he was stating repeatedly that he can't breathe. And he was getting a little weaker in his speech. There was one moment in the video where I heard one of the officers saying, I think he's passing out. That would have been an opportunity to quickly relieve him from that position of not getting enough oxygen, perhaps turn him into a recovery position and allow him to start to expand his lungs again and bring in oxygen and get rid of carbon dioxide. So in addition to not putting him in that position in the first place, when there were signs that he was worsening, repositioning him, I think very likely would have also saved his life.
That was cardiologist Jonathan Rich testifying for the prosecution today in the Derek Chauvin trial and the death of George Floyd. We are going to take a break at the top of the hour for news. When we come back, we are going to be joined by Chicago Tribune columnist Heidi Stevens right after this.
Podcasts of Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive, are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud. Just search WCPT 820. Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive.
Quite frankly, I get most of my news from you.
Joan Esposito.
Y'all ready for this?
On WCPT 820.
One of the people we most enjoy talking to on this show is Chicago Tribune columnist Heidi Stevens. She hasn't been here for a while, but she's here today. Hello, Heidi. How are you?
Hi, Joan. I'm okay. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. I got both my shots and I'm feeling invincible.
Yay.
Hey, Heidi. I was looking at your columns because we always talk about what you've been writing about. And a little while ago, I refreshed and you had just posted a column today. But what I wanted to ask you about was for the first time that I remember seeing a little banner popped up and said, thank you for supporting our journalism. This article is available exclusively for our subscribers. Luckily, I happen to be one. For our subscribers okay. who yep. help fund our work at the Chicago Tribune. So does this mean that your columns are now going to be behind a paywall?
So a lot of them are. This is a new experiment we're trying. I don't know if my bosses would like the word experiment because it's on temporary, and I think they're planning on this being permanent. But, yeah, we're taking some of our content, some stories and columns, and putting them behind a hard paywall, meaning that you don't even get those two free clicks per month before you hit our paywall. You just hit the paywall immediately. So you have to be a subscriber to read it. It's it's an attempt to lure people in to subscribing right away. I have mixed feelings about it, I'll be honest. I think it can be a big ask, especially for newcomers to the site, and we do want to attract newcomers to our site. We're trying to make inroads into communities where we haven't traditionally had a lot of readers or subscribers. So I think it's a big ask to assume that they will immediately subscribe the first time they click on a story. I think it's, a little bit more generous and understanding of people's habits and financial realities to, let them build up a little bit of a relationship with us before we ask them to open their wallets. But this is something that the company is trying, so we'll see.
Well, it's interesting because not only do I subscribe to a very large number of publications and newsletters, also, because a lot of times on social media, somebody will write something and they'll link to the article, whether it's the Financial Times or Bloomberg News or something. And sometimes, just today, I clicked a link that took me to the Financial Times. And at least I got the warning, we're going to give you like 2-3 free articles a month and then it's over. And yeah. I appreciate that. And if it turns out to be a publication that I find myself linking to and clicking on a lot, then I usually do subscribe. But it is very frustrating for me when when I try to click a link to some publication that I've never really read before, and I can't even read one article. I think to myself, why did this person bother linking if the only people who can read this are subscribers? And frankly, if you give me a few articles free and I really like the reporting and I feel that it's really worthwhile, I'll subscribe. But if you don't give me even a little bit for free, I don't really know who you are. I don't know your writing style. I don't know if you have a point of view. I don't know, you know, who your staff is. And I just like, and then I just, in the future, when I see those links, I don't even click on them. So it's, I think that there's got to be a perfect way to do it. You know, you don't want to give everything away for free, but you do want to give people a taste.
Well, a lot of people are calling for sort of single story rights where you just can buy, you know, access to one story at a time, sort of an a la carte. And I think that's a great idea. I would love to see us explore that. I'm also not opposed to, you know, and in fact, see a lot of value in like the Block Club model or the NPR model, where you ask a certain number of people to be members and to, you know, pledge monthly support. And with that support, you are able to open up access to the entire public. I really like that model because, you know, it's interesting when the Tribe first launched, I wrote a story on them a few years ago. And it was a new, you know, a new model at the time. And one of the founders told me, we're not going to ask people to pay for our content because, you know, often we're going into communities and asking people to trust us and talk to us sometimes on, you know, maybe the worst day of their life if we're covering a crime story, for example. And then we're going to say, turn around and give us money to read what we just wrote about you or your neighbor. And it just doesn't feel like sort of morally right. And I see that point. You know, I also obviously I'm a Tribune writer. I've been there 23 years. I know the financial pitfalls and winds of change and all that stuff. And I know that you need people to pay for your products. But I think just sort of an across the board, like, you know, trust me, it's good. It's worth your money. Give us your money. I don't know that's going to fly.
And something else, I don't know if you saw this, and I'm sorry I didn't send you this article before we went on the air. Somebody sent me a link to the Sacramento Bee. I, of course, lived in Sacramento, and I'm very familiar with the Sacramento Bee, which is, despite its kind of silly name, it's a very good newspaper.
Yeah.
And they have just hired a new reporter, and it is a black reporter, and the sole mission for this reporter is covering black communities and black issues. You know, like here in Chicago, you know, we used to have the Defender. And, you know, because a lot of times communities of color didn't feel that they were getting coverage from what they viewed as largely white mainstream media. So they're, you know, like sort of like probably part of why the Tribe was created. It's an online news source. But the Sacramento Bee has decided that the African American community in and of itself is and should be a beat. I thought that was a really interesting idea.
Yep. They launched what they're calling the Sacramento Bee's Equity Lab. And this is, I think you're talking about Marcus Smith.
I think I
read that same article and I thought it was brilliant. And I think, you know, I think the Tribune would benefit greatly from something like that. We really have a history of, and we have a lot of conversations about this, and some of them are really painful. We've been having a lot of them this past week, honestly. We often write about communities instead of for communities, and we have a lot of work to do to earn the trust of a lot of those communities that we should be writing for and talking with instead of to and too often down to. And so, you know, I think something like Sacramento is doing would be brilliant to do here in Chicago and for the Tribune to be the place that does it.
Well, to give myself a plug, yes, I'm going to give myself a plug. I'm actually going to be talking to Marcus Smith on Friday.
Oh, nice.
about this whole effort to hire a black reporter and to focus solely on black communities and this. You know, it's the Black Club Chicago has the same sort of idea where, you know, like, well, it like used to be more in the mainstream media where somebody had a pretty narrow beat, you know, Black Club, they focus on one or two or three neighborhoods. And I think it's a model that really makes a lot of sense because you really get to know whether it's your community or your subject matter. I mean, if you're an education reporter and you only report on education, you learn everything there is to know about education. And I think that's of real value to the people who journalists serve.
I totally agree. I'm so glad you're talking to him. I can't wait to listen.
Yeah. Let's take one quick phone call before we go to break. Julia is calling in from Homewood. Hey, Julia, you're on with Joan and Heidi.
Hi, Joan and Heidi. Thank you so much for being there. And what an important topic today in general. I did call to talk about access to news stories on through social media. You were talking about not getting access. And there was a big lawsuit in Australia where they were trying to sue Facebook because he was refusing to pay the news organizations for all the access. And then, so I'm not sure what's happening with that right there, with that lawsuit, but I know that they are also thinking about this in America. Like, you know, we have great institutions in America, great newspapers, great reporters, some who have to travel around the world. And because we're in this transitional period coming away from paper newspapers to electronic through the internet, and as you had mentioned, through social media, you know, this is a very important conversation. And how are our journalists going to be paid for the very good work that they're doing? And furthermore, I just wanted to add the one piece that has really got my whatever, but it's these billionaires who are going around buying up the newspapers, and they're changing them, and they're breaking the unions of the newspapers, and they're changing the content, and they're trying to put a very right-leaning influence on our great newspapers. I mean, newspapers that have been around for
Well, some of them
years,
are good and,
you know?
And some of them are bad. And, you know, honest, I mean, when Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, the only mandate he gave them, he said, I don't want you to be a local paper. I want you to be a national paper. And he put his money where his mouth was and gave them the resources to do the kind of reporting that, frankly, in my estimation, and I know this is heresy, Heidi, but I actually think the Washington Post right now, to me, is a better paper for news and breaking news than the New York Times. I mean, the New York Times does culture, they do science and stuff, but as far as what's going on in the country, I think the best paper in the country is the Washington Post for that national perspective.
Yeah, thank who would have guessed, but it turned out to be the best thing that could have happened to them. I mean, we've had our experiences with bad billionaires. You know, we had Sam Zell. And, you know, now we're sort of pinning our hopes on maybe a good billionaire, this, you know, Hans Verge.
Mr. Wiese.
And he's, you know, seems to be kind of a lefty environmentalist. We'll see, you know, whether the deal comes through. We'll see what kind of owner he is, if he becomes our owner. But yeah, I don't, billionaire doesn't automatically equal bad owner or good owner. You know, we've sort of, and Black Club too, Black Club's earlier iteration, right? When it was DNA Info, they were owned by a billionaire that then sort of got tired of the, you know, little vanity project and shut them down when they tried to unionize. So you sort of don't know what you're going to get. But the caller is exactly right. You know, these jobs and these papers cost money to operate, and you've got to, you know, you've got to fund that in some way. But you know, the ad model has dried up, and classifieds aren't coming back, and even print may sort of slowly disappear. But and all those print ad dollars. So it's a tricky question.
Well, if people have to pay by article, it's going to be an interesting situation in your home. I mean, you and Michael, or Heidi's husband, writes for the Tribune. You're going to be like, well, I made this amount of money today. Well, I brought in this amount of money on my listeners. It could make for some marital tension in the Heidi Stevens household. Stay tuned. Listen, Heidi, let's take a break. And I do want to get you to weigh in on, of course, the Derek Chauvin trial and everything that's happening today before we move on to lighter subjects. Heidi Stevens and I will be back after this.
Want to add your two cents? You can now call or text us at 773-763-9278. WCPT's text line is sponsored by GWC Injury Lawyers. Visit them at justicestartstoday.com.
Chicago's Progressive Talk, WCPT 820, where facts matter.
You know what time it is? It's time to return to the best progressive talk show in Chicago.
I'm a longtime listener.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive. Now on WCPT 820.
I am joined by Chicago Tribune columnist Heidi Stevens. And Heidi, today we have, of course, been talking about the situation in Brooklyn Center, a suburb of Minneapolis, where a 20-year-old pulled over for a traffic stop, ended up being shot to death by police. While the Derek Chauvin trial is starting its third week, you know, the prosecution expected to wrap up this week. But one of the things that it that we talked about earlier today, Heidi, was this idea that quite possibly we ask too much of our police officers. They're supposed to, you know, react to violent crime. They're supposed to be traffic cops. They're supposed to be social workers. They're supposed to be mental health workers. I know that one of our callers has been waiting a while to weigh in on this part of our conversation. Tom is calling in from Arlington Heights. Hey, Tom, you're on with Joan and Heidi. How are you?
Hi, Joan and Heidi. How are you?
Good.
Hey, Tom.
Hello, Joan and Heidi.
Yes, we're here.
Okay. The reason I'm calling is you had mentioned before, like you just said before I was picked up, that we don't have the right kind of policemen showing up for the right kind of incidents that they have. And, you know, I was thinking that, you know, people call that defunding the police. I'm not too sure that's a good name for it. But if you want to use those terms, we defunded the fire department a long time ago when we used to have you know, guys with hoses and ladders showing up at car crashes and heart attacks, and they brought an ambulance that looked like a hearse, you know, and we decided, you know what, maybe we should have paramedics and have them show up with a truck that looks like an ER bay instead of a, you know, the hearse. And people were trained to do things like, you know, give injections or start IVs or do things, and I don't think there was a big problem with people saying, you know, that's not a bad idea to, you know, redeploy our people and let those, you know, well-meaning people with the ladders and the hoses show up for things that they're really designed to do. And we also did that in education. If you think back to Title IX, most people think of that as being something that was a benefit to females in terms of being able to participate in sports. But a lot of people also don't realize that up until that time, many school districts could just say, you know, we don't want to deal with the severely handicapped. I had a sister who was like that, and they just said, she's just so far handicapped, there's nothing we can do, so we're not going to offer any services. And you know, after Title IX was passed, they basically said, you know, if you can't deal with the type of students that you have to find some type of entity that can. And so they were able to, you know, start placing severely handicapped students into other areas. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of reevaluated how we were doing education before, and we defined it to fit, you know, the situation that people encounter, just like we redefined how the fire department dealt with things. And I don't see it's a big, I don't see it as a big ask to say, you know what, maybe we should look at how the police department deals with things. Like if you give somebody deadly force and a taser and that's all they've got, maybe a nightstick, you know, and they're showing up to deal with stuff where, you know, they may have somebody who's deaf and they don't realize that they're deaf and hard of hearing and they're not listening to what they're saying because they can't hear. I mean, there's so many things where people who are trained, you know, when you're a hammer, everything's a nail. If you show off you know, the wrong tools, you're not going to be able to fix the problem.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's what I have to say. My suggestion was that reevaluate how to deal with the problems.
Yeah, and I appreciate that call, Tom. And, you know, people have, I like the fact that, there are lots of ideas out there. You know, some people have said, well, certain 911 calls should only be answered by a mental health professional, or if there's a police presence, it should only be there as backup, or there should be a greater resources. Because sometimes, Heidi, it does feel like anytime we have a societal problem, you know, the police will deal with that. You know, the police will deal with our unruly person who's in the middle of a schizophrenic breakdown. You know, the police will deal with this situation and that situation. And it really is asking a lot. Not that, and as one of our listeners has texted in, that doesn't excuse anybody who does the wrong thing. And it certainly is no defense for an officer who apparently thought she was pulling a taser and didn't realize somehow that she had a gun in her hand. Those kinds of things. I'm not making excuses for things like that. I'm just saying that we do ask a lot of these people.
I have two thoughts about that. I think the person who texted is exactly right. And you know, my first thought is that are we offering enough mental health supports to our police officers? Mm-hmm. And my hunch is no, given the number of suicides we've seen just here in Chicago alone in 2021. I think extreme fight or flight to the point of violent fight approach that it seems like officers are bringing to these situations. I think that, you know, that in a lot of cases, it's, you know, the feeling has to be that they're in sort of a wartime setting and, you know, approaching with the fear of losing their own lives. So that, mm-hmm. you know, that needs to be acknowledged and addressed and trained for and accommodated. I also think you can't have this conversation without acknowledging the racial disparity, though, in the police killings. I mean, there is not an epidemic of white people being pulled over and shot to death. So there has to be a way in which we address, the way that some officers view black bodies and black drivers, because this, you know, this is as people will frequently point out, and I get these emails, and I'm sure you do too. Police officers kill more white people in a year than they kill black people, but proportionately compared to the number of people in America who are white versus the number of people who are black, it's about three times your chances of getting killed by a police officer are about three times higher if you're a black person. And that is, you know, that we can't have this conversation without acknowledging that.
Yeah. Heidi and I are going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with more right after this.
Facebook.
Message us.
Instagram.
Follow us.
Twitter.
Tweet us.
They keep me connected.
Let's get social on the socials. WCPT 820. This is Joan Esposito. Live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
I am joined by Heidi Stevens, Chicago Tribune columnist, and we have been talking about the events of the day, specifically the shooting of Dante Wright in Brooklyn Center, a suburb of Minneapolis, as in Minneapolis, the Derek Chauvin trial for the killing of George Floyd is beginning its third week. We have been talking about police and what we ask of them and their training. We have a caller who wants to join that conversation. Phil is calling in from Dixon, Illinois. Hey, Phil, you're on with Joan and Heidi.
Hi. My grandfather used to be captain of a police force in the Second City, Illinois, right now. And after him was my uncle. And they used to talk. I remember them talking when I was small that you didn't want policemen who were too smart because you wanted them to follow through on their training. You didn't want them asking the questions, should I be doing this? Is this right? You just wanted them to follow through like an automaton. You know, follow through on their training, and it seems to me that's something what's going on right now.
Well, you know, also, I understand a little bit about that because that kind of training makes sense when you are in a life-threatening situation. I mean, I think the fear is if a police person takes too much time to, you know, well, you know, what about this? What about that? I mean, I think that they're trained to react quickly when they feel their life is in danger. I think the problem we have is that same training seems to kick in circumstances that, at least to those of us who are outside observers, we don't really see the life-threatening danger that that they seem to be reacting to. But go ahead, I interrupted you.
Yeah, so then here's another story. We had a DCFS person was being sent to a home to pick up a child to put into foster care. The child was with his grandparents and his father, who was a felon, I think. Anyhow, and she usually had a police escort, but this day she did not have a police escort. But someone from the police station called that family to let them know that the DCFS person was coming to get the child. Well, the father met her at her car, and he beat her up, and she eventually died.
Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a horrific situation, and that's why some people say that even if a mental health officer is dispatched to a scene, that there should be some sort of backup available. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that's a really horrific story. I'm so upset to hear that. And not that I doubt that it happened, because it sounds like the kind of thing that would happen. But, you know, there's got to be a balance. We've got to find the right balance when police should be there, when they should be in the background, when they should take center stage, what amount of force they should use. The way we're doing it now doesn't seem to be working for everybody.
Right. And I think we also need to ask why so often shooters who have just shot up a school, or in the case of Dylann Roof, a church, and are arrested alive without incident. And yet this man today seems to have been shot dead over air fresheners hanging from his rearview mirror. I just think that we have to ask a question. What is the difference here? In the case of, you know, the 13-year-old shot in Chicago recently, and I don't doubt that these situations are terrifying and do seem life or death in the moment for police officers. But it seems like, from, as you said, an outside observer standpoint, sometimes the training and the de-escalation training and the humanity kicks in, and other times it doesn't. And it seems also, as an outside observer, that the times that it doesn't kick in are when the victims aren't white. And so I just don't know how you have these conversations without acknowledging that.
And when we first started reporting on the Derek Chauvin trial, one of my listeners texted in and said that they were, you know, a white person, and they were at a store, and they tried to pay with cash they thought was good, and the store clerk said, "This is a counterfeit bill." And the person said the store clerk handed the bill back, the person apologized, paid with their credit card, and left. No muss, no fuss.
Right.
But there does seem to be a racial component to how these things turn out more often than not. Let's take one more call. Jerry is calling in from Richland Park. Hey, Jerry, how are you?
Hey, Joan, how you doing?
Good.
I'm just calling in because I listen to a lot of things, and when I hear that, you know, now we have sympathy for the poor policeman who have so much to do that they have to shoot people. They don't shoot white people like that. So
that's what Heidi and I were just talking about,
There's nothing. Yeah, that's nothing to do with, you know, how what the job is. You don't go around shooting people like these guys are shooting. I saw two things, and I've been watching it all my life, and I have my own podcast. I'm supposed to get back to you, and I will on that. But I've been watching it all my life, and I'm watching what happened. I said years ago, wait until you see the videos. You'll see for yourself. And these are just a few that you see on the videos. Imagine what's really going on out here. And let me say this one thing. I watched Phil Donahue, I think it was Phil Donahue's show, years ago, when they had Ku Klux Klan and some Malcolm, the Black Panthers, Farrakhan people on. And they got into a scuffle there. You know, it was a scuffle on TV. And I remember this guy saying, this was way back, he said, yeah, well, you know what? Because they kind of got beat up a little bit, the Klan. You know what? Yo, we're going to join the police force. We're going to become legislators. And we'll be able to kill these in people legally. They said that back then. I got it on film if you want to see it. They said it back then. Oh, I mean, and this is what's going on. It's crazy.
And not just in police forces. I've been doing a lot of reading in the last couple of years where the military has found the same thing, that white nationalists are drawn to the military and or they convert recruits to their way of thinking, that it's not something that gets a lot of publicity, but it is a problem that the armed forces realizes that it has. Thank you for that call. I appreciate it. Heidi and I are going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to take one or two more calls on this, and then I want to talk to Heidi about her most recent column. All that and more right after this.
If you missed any of today's show, you can listen on SoundCloud or iTunes. Just search WCPT 820. Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive. Because facts matter. You're listening to WCPT 820. Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
If this is a topic that you find yourself interested in, I want to let you know that the ACLU is actually going to do a live stream program from 7 to 8 p.m. on Monday, April 19th. It is about law enforcement accountability. It's called No More Bad Apples, a conversation on police accountability. Again, it's going to be a live stream from the ACLU on the 19th from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. You can go to the ACLU of Illinois site to find out how to log into that. Let's take one more phone call, and then we're going to move on. Mark is calling in from Wheeling. Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm just fine. How are you, Joan? Thanks for taking my call. Good. I'm a big fan, by the way, of you and everybody else at the station.
Thank you. We all thank you.
Okay. I'll try to be brief and succinct. I'm a little nervous. I've never been on the radio. But currently, I'm an occupational therapist, but before I did that, I worked with the developmentally disabled, persons who were autistic, brain injured, and frequently they would become violent and we would have to subdue them. Now, I don't suppose it would be okay if we took a gun and shot them, would it? We would have to use our best means, and usually that would involve a wrestling move, a judo move that we were trained in. I am also a former wrestler, so I knew how to do it, but we would have to subdue the client and basically restrain them, sit on them until they calm down. And, you know, we might have gotten scratched or kicked a little bit or bitten here and there, but usually never severely injured. And things turned out fine. You know, 10 or 15 minutes, the people would calm down, and they would be alive and nobody would be bleeding.
Yeah, which is a really strong argument for making sure that somebody with de-escalation training shows up to some of these police calls where that's exactly the talent that's needed. Thank you, Mark. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for calling in and sharing that story. And you were just fine. No need to be nervous. You're a radio natural. So you can call in anytime. Heidi, before we end our broadcast today, I wanted to talk about your newest article, the one you posted, I think, about an hour before we started this conversation. And I didn't realize that HIV-positive people could be organ donors. Tell the listeners about your story.
Yeah, so this is very new. Obama signed what is called the HOPE Act, stands for HIV Organ Policy Equity Act, in 2013. And what that did was lift the ban on scientists actually just researching organ donations from one person with HIV to another person with HIV. And that paved the way for people who are HIV positive to donate their organs and have them placed into the bodies of other people who are HIV positive. So the column I wrote today was an interview with a couple from Chicago who just had that very thing done. A guy named Al needed a kidney. He was diagnosed with chronic kidney failure in 2017. His husband at the time, Reed, qualified to donate his kidney. It was a good, you know, match, blood type and all that. And so they went ahead with, you know, sort of started that process, which can be quite long. You have to do all sorts of tests as a donor and a recipient to make sure that, you know, this will take. At the time, only one in the entire country had ever been done, one HIV positive, you know, to HIV positive transplant of a kidney had been done. Now they, you know, just completed theirs. They were the third in the country, first in Illinois, to complete that. And they're both doing great. It's, you know, it's a little more complicated for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, obviously once you have an organ transplanted into you, you're on like anti-rejection medication.
Well, yeah, and immunosuppressants. And that would seem
exactly.
to work against the medications that keep the HIV in check. So that's not the case
right.
then?
Well, so Al, who received the kidney, you know, works with an infectious diseases specialist at Northwestern, and she monitors his medication to make sure that the anti-rejection medicine doesn't counteract the antiviral medicine that he's on. And so far, it hasn't, and she's confident that it won't. And so this really opens up a whole new world of, you know, hope, frankly, for people who are living with HIV. It's not, HIV is not the death sentence that we thought it was in the 80s and that it was in the 80s. You know, there's been all sorts of advancements in the treatment of HIV. So you can live with HIV for a long, long time. And you know, this is a really positive development that you can be, you know, first of all, be an organ donor, right? Just walk into the DMV and check, yes, I want to donate my organs on the back of your license and not have to explain to anyone that you're HIV positive in that process. And also that if you are living with HIV and need an organ donor, you know, that there's a whole new world of donors out there for you, all sorts of people, thousands of people actually die each year waiting, you know, for a transplant. So this is great news.
Yeah, that's especially it's especially a problem in the African American community. You know, I mean, at one point, Walter Payton, when he was first diagnosed with his liver disease, in the beginning, he could have been cured had he gotten a liver transplant, but with the illness that he had, when it reaches a certain point, morphs into liver cancer, and at that point, you are no longer eligible for a transplant. And it just really brings home the tragedy of people we lose who we don't have to lose. One of the things that I thought was really interesting in what you wrote, though, you know, they may have started this process when they were married, but even after they weren't married, the guy still gave him his kidney. Now, that's a great relationship.
Right? I mean, and just like, what a good, good human. Yeah, they were together since 2009. Obviously, it was not legal to, you know, same-sex marriage was not legal in 2009. But they sort of considered themselves married because they were, you know, monogamous and exclusive for many years. And then they did officially wed in 2017, but the marriage didn't last. They ended up getting divorced a few years later, but they didn't back out of the transplant. You know, Reed had been identified as a match and Al needed that match. And so they went ahead with it. And, you know, when I interviewed them about that, they just both acted like, oh my gosh, of course we went ahead with it. You know, Reed even said like, you know, the nature of your love changes, but you don't stop loving the person. And I was like, well, Yeah, speaking as a divorced person, you kind of do. But I really admired their just humanity and generosity. And honestly, you know, the way that they're being pioneers for the whole population of people, right, who now have some hope.
And, you know, also being in the divorced club, you know, I could say that I am still friendly, very friendly with my exes, one of whom I have to be friendly with because we share a child. And the other just for no other reason than, you know, my attitude is, you know, sometimes people are abusive and they're horrible and they do horrible things to people. And I certainly wouldn't expect anybody in a situation like that to maintain a relationship. But if you're a nice person and they're a nice person and you just kind of figured out that you weren't going in the same direction or you wanted different things out of life, you know, they don't stop being a nice person just because you divorce them. So, you know, what the heck?
Well, actually, it's funny you say that because a couple of years ago, I think it was, I could look it up, but I think it was like 2018, I wrote a story about a state rep, Deb Conroy, who donated her kidney to her ex-husband. They had, I mean, they were, you know, not married for years, but they had four sons together and he needed a kidney and she was a match. And she was like, how am I going to turn away the father of my sons? Like, I don't want my sons to lose their dad. If I can keep their dad alive, of course I'm going to do that. And I thought that was really beautiful too.
I have a friend who's divorced and she gets along with her ex, he gets along with her, but they knew at the time of their divorce they have a son. I don't remember what illness the son has, but they knew eventually the son was not only going to need a kidney transplant, but also a liver transplant. So they divided it up. Mm. You know, you do the liver, I'll do the kidney. And when the time comes, so they're still very supportive of one another in that way.
That's awesome.
Isn't that a great story? You do the liver, I'll do the kidney.
Yeah. And they were both matches. That's great.
Yeah. So it is possible. Not that I would necessarily give an organ to my first husband. I mean, he's a great guy. I don't mind being connected with him on Facebook. But it would be. But for the father of my daughter, I mean, she would never forgive me if I didn't do everything I could to keep him alive. So I would probably do that. But you know,
But it's a big ask.
And like with the HIV, I'm in kind of a weird category as a cancer survivor because I'm not sure how many of my parts they'll take, to be quite honest, Heidi.
Yeah, it's not a given. I mean, that was part of the reason this process took so long. You know, Reed was identified as a match in 2018. They just had the surgery done. And part of it is they're very, very careful that they're not going to put the donor's life at risk. And of course, Reed is HIV positive too. So they're not trying to, you know, damage his, you know, prospects at a long, healthy life in the process of saving someone else's. So, it's not as though you say, okay, you know, where do I sign? And they take your organ.
Exactly. Heidi, thank you so much for being here today. I love talking to you. It has been too long, my friend.
Well, thank you for having me. I always love being on your show.
Well, you're very welcome. And if it does get to the point where the Tribune charges per article, I promise I will buy all of yours over and above my subscription. Yes. We'll show that Michael Phillips a thing or two.
Thanks, Joan.
Thank you. That is going to wrap it up for us today. I do want to remind you of something that I mentioned earlier. For those of you who are regular listeners, and I think that's pretty much all of you, we now have a club. We're forming a club. Next thing, we'll be forming a political party. Maybe, I don't know. But first, we're starting with a club, the WCPT 820 Club. You can go to our website, and you will see that there is a WCPT 820 Club tab in the menu. Just click it, and you can find out how to sign up. It's going to provide you with news of our events and contests, and there's going to be lots of fun stuff, caption contests, polls, trivia, surveys, games, all kinds of fun things to do with like-minded people. Right now, we have Ted Cruz caption contest. It's not going to be up there forever. It's up there right now. So remember, go to our website, WCPT820.com, and you will see a tab that says WCPT 820 Club. I am lobbying for hats and a secret handshake. I will let you know when they finally agree to have those things for our club. And I just want you to know that our contests are always open to anybody who lives in the area, as long as you're 18 years of age or older, and you can have one winner per household. All of our contest rules are always on our website. Thanks for listening. Rick Unger's next. Santita will be here tomorrow at 6 a.m., and I will see you tomorrow at 2. Have a great evening. Good night.